You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk with a composer and conductor of a Pulitzer Prize-winning piece of music that debuted last Thanksgiving in a cathedral in Milwaukee. Now, insects are everywhere. They're in our gardens, lawns, and homes. The only place they haven't been discovered on Earth is deep, deep in saltwater oceans. They're also a big part of human culture. They star in movies, think Ant-Man and Bug's Life. They influence fashion and even lead to new technologies. Barrett Klein is a biology professor at UW-La Crosse. He studies entomology and the relationship between insects and human culture. Barrett, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have, I understand, an origin story that led you to a lifelong pursuit of the science and art of insects. What is it?
Wow, I guess one origin story is that I was 5 years old and I found a dead insect in my parents' driveway. And I was struck by the beauty. I come from a family of artists, and having this accessible, handleable, gorgeous butterfly dead in my hands inspired, I had an epiphany. I knew that insects would play a central role in my life, just didn't know how.
Now, you do the science of insects, also art, and you discovered that you're not the only person to have that epiphany. Can you talk a little bit about the long tradition of human culture and art being inspired by the world of insects and other arthropods?
Indeed. In fact, we can go back to the beginnings and before the beginnings of human evolution to look at connections primates have had with insects and the earliest hominids had with insects in a variety of forms. For example, simply the eating of insects or the living with of insects. Eating of insects, traditionally, actually, let me ask you, how many insect species do you think humans traditionally consume?
On purpose?
On purpose.
I don't know. I would
actually
guess,
that is an excellent qualifier because the Federal Drug Administration allows certain parts per thousand or million of insects and orange juice and countless other things that we consume. So all of us are entomophagists to some extent.
I would guess probably a low number, like 12 or 20 species. I'm guessing I'm way low on ones we eat on purpose.
A couple magnitudes off. A very conservative estimate would be 1,611 by a recent publication, as in a month or two ago. But that's a very conservative estimate because traditional practices, for example, in Oaxaca, Mexico, number 146 species of insects alone used today.
Now, you do art, and you are inspired by the insect world. What kind of things do you do?
Oh, a lot. I used to do scientific illustration, and I still do to some extent today, but I used to make natural history displays at a studio in Missouri and then at the American Museum of Natural History. And I was hired on essentially as an entomologist who creates art. So I fused the science and art in a way that could inspire or educate the public. So I mold cast sculptures of insects I made, paint them to put them on display in dioramas, but also thermographic videos. What I'm really excited recently in producing are sculptures made from insect products. So I keep some honeybee hives, and I might stick a bicycle helmet in there, an old broken bicycle helmet, see how they build on that, and then collaborate with them. Built with more beeswax to produce these elaborate helmets.
I'm going to ask for a brief answer to a huge question. Can you talk about just the range of symbolism that bugs offer in art, in the art world, in different cultures? It's not all just, ooh, bugs, icky.
Yeah, so symbolism can take many different forms, and we can reach into ancient Egyptian symbols, for example, in mythology, all the way to symbols today. And I'll go backwards. I'll go forwards. I'll start chronologically. So if we think about Khepri, the god of in ancient Egyptian mythology, the symbol is a dung beetle, a sacred scarab beetle that would roll the spherical ball of dung, like a celestial body, the sun, across the sky. To today, you could go to Enterprise, Alabama, and see the herald of prosperity in the form of a boll weevil beetle being held aloft by a statue because they celebrate this pest or this insect that would destroy a crop so that they would it basically caused them to be more enterprising and look to other crops for their success stories. And they recognize that. But you'll also find insects on currencies around the world. My wedding ring is made of a Greek coin that's 2,000 years old with a honeybee on it. But you have currency both in coin and bill form that feature insects for various reasons, and postal stamps and beyond.
We'll leave it there for now, but I hope we can talk more about this in the future. Barrett, thanks a lot for
Yeah.
joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Barrett Klein, professor of biology at UW-La Crosse. We talked with Barrett about how bugs, insects influence human culture and art. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about caring for the ones we love.
Many of us reach a point in life when it's our turn to take care of our parents. That was the case for Hedy Lamarr Rudd, whose father, Lavelle, had an enormous impact on her life and left a lasting impression on everyone who knew him. She shares their story at the UW Continuing Studies Writers Institute.
My father, Lavelle F. Rudd, had replacement parts all over his body. His hips were replaced and he still tried to straddle a motorcycle. The source of his fragility and his strength was a diagnosis of lupus that he received when he was released from prison around 1978. I remember his being angry at first because he didn't know what was wrong. His fingers hurt, he said. I remember him saying, "How does a black man go to the doctor and cry that his fingers hurt?" Eventually, his already dark fingers turned black with gangrene, resulting in the amputation of most of them. A musician, a writer, a mechanic, a lover, my father found ways to use those nubs to accomplish his goals, but he was never the same. Fingers gone, hips replaced, knees next, and then the glorious day when he received a halo, a contraption that surrounded his chest with bars up to and surrounding his skull to keep his neck and spine from moving. One day, he grew very sick, slipping into a coma. He was brought to Mariner Hospital rather than University Hospital, which is where he was normally treated. A few hours later, the phone rang. "Miss Rudd, this is Mariner Hospital. Your father has checked himself out." "Excuse me," I said. "He was just in a coma. How could he check himself out?" The doctor went on to explain that he had awakened shortly after we left and demanded to be released. They told him that he was in no position to be released and explained why he had been admitted. So as soon as he was left alone, he unplugged his IV tubes, put on a multicolored robe, hospital slippers, and walked out of the hospital. We followed his elusive trail on foot and by car, looking everywhere. While it should have been easy to find an elderly black man wearing a Moses robe, it was more difficult than we expected. We returned home to wait for a call from the police, who we hoped would have better luck than we did. When the call came, we rushed to the hospital, and there sat my dad in a wheelchair, with a mischievous grin on his face. The officers explained that they had found him at the Citgo gas station in East Washington. We later found out the little devil had a brain aneurysm, which is how he found himself wearing the halo. Over 100 hip locations, dislocations later, the doctors at University Hospital accused him of purposely dislocating his hip in order to obtain prescription drugs. My dad responded that he could buy much better drugs on the street. To which they chalked him up as a drug addict and began to treat him as such. One resident orthopedic doctor decided that rather than continue to put his hip in place again after being admitted twice in a 24-hour period for separate dislocations, he would put the hip back in and then place a plaster cast around my father's torso. The episode crushed his spirit. A few months later, he was back in the hospital. When I went to visit him, he said, "I shouldn't have woken up this morning. I don't think I will tomorrow." I remember once telling him that I never wanted him to die, and he said he would let me know when he was going to die. I told him that's not how it worked, and in that moment, I told him, "I'll be back to see you the next day." The call came at 3 a.m. that he was finally free. He had kept his promise to me and let me know that it was his time. So after the funeral, we cremated my father. I thought about my father's gifts to the world, his writing, his music, and the memories that others carried of him inside of their hearts. I didn't know if he was in heaven or hell, but I knew that what he left behind was as important as what we lost when he left. And I promised myself that I would live that kind of life, and that when I leave the planet, people will know that I was here. The last promise to keep is mine.
Oh. Teddy Lamar Rudd's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project, where low-income adults find their voices and earn college credit in an English literature course. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, the first Native American to win a Pulitzer Prize for Music tells us about a piece he composed specifically for a Milwaukee cathedral and its pipe organ. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Milwaukee and its organ provided the setting for a prize-winning performance last fall. Voiceless Mass is an all-instrumental, non-traditional piece composed specifically for the space. It debuted at a concert held on Thanksgiving. Raven Chacon composed it. He's an Albuquerque-based composer, performer, and installation artist from Fort Defiance, Navajo Nation. When his Voiceless Mass won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Music last month, he became the first Native American to receive that award. Also with us, David Bloom, co-artistic director and conductor for Present Music, a Milwaukee-based organization that was among the groups that commissioned the work. I talked with both of them earlier today. Raven, let's start with you. First of all, congratulations on the Pulitzer. And can you tell us how you approached this unique project, composing a piece specifically for this unique space?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I was really happy to be invited by Present Music to compose a new piece over the pandemic. You know, as we know, everything was up in the air in terms of if we'd be having concerts, if anything would be in person. And so, I was really excited to be making a new work. And once I learned that it was to be written using the church organ there at the cathedral, this became a new, you know, possibility for me to think about what this piece might mean and what it might be about.
David, can you tell us how this commission came about for Voiceless Mass?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Present Music, I'm one of the two co-artistic directors, and Eric Zegnitz and I were just really taken with Raven's music and his ideas that he puts into his art. And so we said, you know, we just went to Raven and said, basically wrote him a piece of fan mail and said, how can we do your music? How can we work on something new? And what would you want to make? And so he said, we told him a bit about our programs. And he pointed to this one that we do in this cathedral and said, now that sounds interesting. So we were very thrilled to hear about that.
And this is going to be, as I understand it, Raven, for a Thanksgiving performance. Can you talk a little bit about your reaction, your thinking about that timing?
Yeah, it seems like very often I get asked to respond to that anniversary of Thanksgiving. And of course, this is a date every year that Indigenous people in North America, you know, question. And we wonder, you know, what does it mean for us to be involved in the celebration on this date? At the same time, you know, this is a time to gather. Families gather, they have meals together. And so I think all Native people in this country, you know, have a conflict inside of them about what that anniversary means. And so for me to have an invitation to make a piece of music that's going to be premiered on that date, and thinking about the setting of where this is to take place in a Catholic cathedral, and thinking about the history of Indigenous people, my own tribe, with this institution and on this date, you know, all came together in the statement that this music composition makes.
David, can you paint us a visual picture of the setting here, the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Milwaukee, and this Nichols and Simpson organ?
Right. Yeah. So the cathedral is this gorgeous space that Present Music has played in for, you know, 25 years, something like that, annually. So Raven invited us, the ensemble, to spread our 12 musicians throughout the cathedral. So we put our violinists way in the back, our clarinetists and flutists on the sides, you know, cellist on the side. So we basically the work surrounds the audience, and depending on where you're sitting, it's a different experience of the piece. And there are two kind of sources for the organ sound, one in the front of the cathedral and one in the back in a balcony. And so that again is a way that the audience is surrounded by the sound that Raven created.
We're talking about a unique musical composition, a unique musical event that took place in Milwaukee. The composer just won a Pulitzer Prize for it. With us, the composer, Raven Chacon, and David Bloom with Present Music. I want to get a taste of that performance here. I'm going to give a listen. From Voiceless Mass there. Raven, can you talk a little bit about what we were just hearing and how it all came together to create this, like, I guess, audioscape in this setting?
Well, using the organ was, you know, such a great opportunity because you have this full range of pitches, almost to the inaudible lows to the inaudible highs. And so I wasn't approaching the organ in any kind of, you know, maybe like you would hear in Baroque music, any kind of complex melodies or fast runs. In fact, you're just hearing kind of tones dispersed across the composition, and these are supported by the tones that the other instruments are making. One of these instruments is electronic sine tones, which are also capable of being very, you know, inaudible in the low ends and on the upper register, but kind of producing this physical feeling inside of the listener, this kind of this weight, especially in the low end, or this presence that something is there, but you can't quite hear it. And so this makes its way across the composition in different spatial configurations and at different volumes, but overall becoming this kind of unified drone that you hear throughout.
And David, I understand you conducted the actual performance here. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like with this unique piece, the space, and as you mentioned, the musicians scattered around the building?
Yeah. Well, it's always fun to, you know, conduct an ensemble that's 360 degrees around you. so that was my experience for this piece, kind of seeking out the players throughout the house, including the narthex, including just like a football field away, almost. But the process of kind of creating this performance was a really deeply collaborative one, which I really, really appreciate Raven's openness to our ideas as an ensemble. In fact, the work invites improvisation and just the creativity of the ensemble and the musicians. So it was very gratifying to play the piece from that perspective as well.
And Raven, the title again is Voiceless Mass. Now, literally, it's voiceless. There's nobody singing or talking or anything as part of it. Does it mean more than that, the voiceless part of this?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to consider this building where we were performing the music inside of, and the history of the Catholic Church and other institutions, not limited to the church. I mean, I'm thinking of universities, even, where there is the idea that all voices have equity and have the potential to speak, but at the same time, there can be a lot of suppression that happens in these places, and there might only be a positioning of a single voice, even though the intention was for a group of people to be able to express themselves. And so that's what this piece addresses, and it makes available a situation where there's equitable voices. So you have the viola in this instance being probably the quietest instrument in the ensemble, and providing a space where that viola can have the same voice or the same power of voice as, let's say, the organ. And to be able to talk about this through instrumental music is difficult. You know, there are no words. There is no libretto or spoken word to be able to talk about, you know, this history. And this history for me comes from the viewpoint of being an Indigenous person. But so to be able to put that into an instrumental piece of music and have that understood by, you know, let's say the Pulitzer Committee and the broader public is quite an honor. And I'm really happy that I was able to, you know, collaborate with Present Music and have this dialogue with the church. You know, this was commissioned by the United Church of Christ, and that they were open to my ideas on this is, I'm very honored.
Raven, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
And David, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was David Bloom and Raven Chacon. Raven is a composer, performer, and installation artist from Navajo Nation. And David is a co-artistic director and conductor for Present Music. I talked to them earlier today about the piece Voiceless Mass, which Present Music co-commissioned Raven to write for a Thanksgiving concert at the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Milwaukee. Fast forward to last month, Raven received the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Music for that performance, for that composition, becoming the first Native American to get that award. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll visit the Upper Mississippi River with a big new study that looks at the impact of higher water levels, a changing ecosystem, and a warmer climate. We'll find out how that part of the big river has changed over the years. The Underground Railroad helped black people escape slavery in the United States. We'll answer a Why Scotsman question about the Underground Railroad here in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll look at some of the latest news on the U.S.-Mexico border, including a massive tragedy. A number of people died while being smuggled through Texas illegally. We'll find out how that fits into the wider picture of immigration law and border enforcement. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week expanded the right to carry a concealed firearm outside the home, overturning a New York state law. We'll talk to a gun law expert about the case, what it means for the Second Amendment, and how it's applied in states around the country. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a White House aide testified yesterday to the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. We'll look back at what she said, about what the White House knew about the threat of violence that day, and former President Trump's actions. First, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a New York state law last week that required people to show a special need to get a permit to carry a concealed firearm in public. In the 6-3 decision, the court's conservative justices said the right to bear arms for self-defense extends outside the home. The ruling left some states, including California and New Jersey, also working to replace similar laws with new public safety measures. We're talking about what this all means for our understanding of the Second Amendment and what states and local governments can and can't do. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that people should have the right to carry a firearm in public? If so, what would you like to see, if any, kind of permitting process issued by state governments, by local governments? Where do you draw the line on that kind of regulation? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. His work focuses on guns, the Second Amendment, and criminal law. His work was cited in the majority and dissenting opinions in this case. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, can you tell us a little more about what this New York law did and why the court's 6 conservative justices didn't like it?
Sure. So in New York State, in order to carry a handgun in public, you have to get a permit. And in order to get that permit, New York State, since 1913, has required that you show proper cause. And the way that that gets interpreted is by requiring an applicant to show a heightened need for self-defense, something that separates the applicant from the general public. In other words, saying that you just want a permit because you're worried that you might get attacked by a stranger and you want to have a gun for those random acts of violence in order to protect yourself is not enough in New York State. Rather, you need a particularized need that separates you from the general public, like that you've received threats of harm or that you carry a lot of money for your job or something along those lines. Back in the 1980s, most of the country either banned concealed carry altogether or had one of these New York style laws. But today, or at least before the Supreme Court ruling, New York was one of fewer than 10 states, albeit populous states, that had this sort of a policy. About 80 million Americans live in a place where in order to carry a concealed handgun, you need to show this heightened need for self-defense. And that's the policy, and the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional.
So let's look at the arguments from the majority. First of all, why did the majority say this didn't pass muster with their interpretation of the Second Amendment?
So the majority says that you have to implement the Second Amendment. You have to test whether or not gun restrictions pass the Second Amendment are consistent with the Second Amendment by looking at text and history. With respect to text, the Supreme Court said that there is a right to keep and bear arms, and to bear an arm means to carry it. And the court, the majority, says that it might be possible to restrict that right to carry a handgun, but in order to restrict it, you need to be able to point to historical analogs that are consistent with a modern day regulation. And by historical analogs, we're not talking about 100 years ago. After all, the New York State policy at issue is from the 1910s. They're looking at whether or not there's a historical analog that goes back to the founding period. 1791 is when the Second Amendment got enacted, or into the 1800s and maybe up through when the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868. And one of the things that the court, the majority did, was they went through all these historical laws and they said that none of them were close enough, none of them were good enough to uphold New York's law.
What did the minority argue in response, the three justices who voted to preserve New York's law?
Well, the dissenting justices, in this case, was 6-3, as you mentioned, and in the majority were the six conservative justices, and in the dissent were the three more liberal justices on the bench. They took issue with this test to begin with. This isn't the way that individual rights traditionally or conventionally get implemented. Ordinarily, there is a consideration of whether or not a modern day restriction sufficiently furthers a sufficiently important government interest, and preventing gun violence is no doubt a compelling government interest. So they took issue with this approach altogether. They said it's an odd way to do constitutional law. And beyond that, they did their own historical analysis, and they thought that the analogs, the historical tradition of restricting guns in public that dates all the way back to the medieval times, is sufficient to uphold this good cause permitting law that New York State has.
We're talking to Eric Rubin from the Southern Methodist University School of Law, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court ruling from last week overturning a New York law on concealed carry permits and the way they work. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about all this. That's 800-642-1234. What restrictions, if any, should states have when it comes to publicly carrying firearms? Are there restrictions you think are consistent with the Second Amendment? Call 800-642-1234. So, Eric, obviously this New York law overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, you mentioned a handful of other states with similar laws. Does this go beyond that, though? Does this call into question other gun regulations that aren't so specifically like this concealed carry permit concern?
Well, the answer there is yes. Now, to be sure, one of the things that the Supreme Court did say in its opinion was that the court was not calling into question permitting laws that have objective criteria for carrying a concealed handgun in public. So many states have so-called shall issue permitting laws where you still need to get a license in order to carry a concealed handgun, but the government doesn't have discretion to deny the license based on your showing of some heightened need to carry a lethal weapon. So in places with these shall issue permitting laws, you might have to go through a background check and do some training, both in the classroom and also live fire. But you wouldn't have to convince a licensing official that you are in danger and that's why you need to carry a handgun. The court says, both in the majority opinion and the concurrences, they make clear that this opinion does not call into doubt those policies, which is somewhat interesting because there isn't a founding era analog to such licensing laws. But in any event, one of the things that the court did here, as I mentioned before, was it said that you have to adjudicate Second Amendment questions by looking solely to text and history. And that's a big change from the way that the lower courts have been deciding Second Amendment issues in the past decade and a half or so. So this will, in fact, affect other challenge laws, whether it's a ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines or restrictions on people who are 18 to 21 possessing a firearm. This changes the way that those sorts of cases get decided. And over the past decade and a half, most challenge gun laws have been upheld. In other words, courts have been rejecting Second Amendment challenges by changing the methodology and requiring gun laws to be shored up solely on the basis of history. That is a change that will call into question all of these other laws that have already been deemed constitutional, and courts are going to be asked to take a closer look or another look based on this new methodology. Now, I should make clear that history is always important. It's important to all judges. Judges frequently will look to history when trying to understand what the Constitution means, but most judges don't think that that's the exclusive thing that should be taken into consideration. Modern day problems and modern day gun violence have also come into play when the lower courts have been deciding on the constitutionality of gun restrictions. But the court has said that that modern day violence is no longer relevant to the analysis.
We're talking to Eric Rubin, professor of law at Southern Methodist University, expert on firearm law, breaking down the U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week that struck down a New York state law required proof of a special need before getting a concealed carry permit, finding out what that means for other kinds of firearm laws in states around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? If you've been looking at it, do you have questions about it and what it means for wider Second Amendment related issues? What abilities do you think states or local governments should have to limit publicly carrying firearms, to require permits? Call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with Eric Rubin. He's a law professor at Southern Methodist University, expert on the Second Amendment, looking at last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling expanding the right effectively to carry a gun in public as they overturned a New York state law requiring proof of a special need to get a concealed carry permit for handguns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear what you think about this? What extent you think state or local governments should be able to issue permits, to set expectations for permits for concealed carry? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Dick is with us in Brooklyn, the Wisconsin Brooklyn, not the New York State one. Dick, hi. Nope, he's not ready. Sorry. We'll get to him in just a minute. So before we do go to callers, then how I want to talk about, you mentioned a couple times the last decade and a half of gun regulation. That's going back to the Heller ruling. Can you talk about what changed there?
Sure. So Heller, District of Columbia v. Heller was the 2008 decision where for the first time in the country's history, the Supreme Court declared that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms that is not centrally focused on the militia, which is the topic of the first half of the Second Amendment, but rather is at its core about private self-defense. The significance of this was that before that opinion, the consensus in the federal courts was that there is no Second Amendment problem unless a person who is challenging a law as it relates to service in a well-regulated militia. The Second Amendment provides a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And that first half of the amendment, those 13 words about the militia, were seen as a limitation on the Second Amendment right. In 2008, the Supreme Court declared that those first 13 words are not a limitation on the right, that the right at its core is about private self-defense, and therefore a ban on handguns in the District of Columbia was unconstitutional. And that opinion, Heller, is still the lodestar Second Amendment opinion that has been guiding a wave of challenges to weapons laws across the country. That case, however, did not deal with the issue that was decided last week. It was about having a handgun in the home. Last week, the issue was whether or not you can carry that handgun into public spaces.
Let's go to our callers. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hi.
Yes, I have a question regarding how far the law really goes. And I look at all this discussion about the ability to have weapons with high-capacity magazines, rapid fire. So where does it end? What if I want to put a tank out in front of my front yard because I want more firepower to defend myself? This is a rhetorical question, obviously, but I like your opinion as to where does this end?
Dick, thanks for the call. Yeah, arms covers a lot of ground from, I guess, a knife to a nuclear weapon. There's a line. I think there's always going to be a line there somewhere, Eric.
Yeah, and this is so this was a topic that wasn't at issue in this case, but it's a good question. It's one that's it's been litigated in the past and it will continue to be litigated. Obviously, at the time that the Second Amendment was enacted, firearms were by and large muskets. They were muzzle loaders. They took time to load. They were inaccurate. You couldn't carry them around loaded because they could misfire. Technology has advanced a great deal. So the courts have to decide, as a threshold matter, what counts as an arm. And most of the courts that have considered the issue have said that machine guns, for instance, simply are not covered by the Second Amendment. Fully automatic weapons simply are not covered. Now, semi-automatic weapons like AR-15 style guns that have been used in recent mass shootings, that's a closer call, though the consensus in the federal courts thus far is that it's constitutional to ban them. And it's also been the consensus that it's constitutional to ban large capacity magazines. In terms of a tank, my guess is that courts would universally, under whatever test you wanted to apply, say that you have no Second Amendment right to have a tank in your front yard because that is simply not what we count as an arm. Now, one question that's open after this opinion last week is whether this consensus about AR-15 style weapons is up for grabs. And I think in that respect, it's worth noting that the Supreme Court is holding four cases right now. We're gonna find out on Friday whether or not it will be hearing any of these cases next year. And three of them deal with either assault weapons or large capacity magazines. So maybe in answer to Dick's question, next year we'll find out just how far the court is going to go in this regard.
Dick, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Deonora joins us now in Racine. Hello, Deonora.
Hi. My question is, I know that they talk a lot about these gun laws, but the real problem is all these criminals that have guns, they will always be able to get guns. How are they going to take care of that?
Deonora, thanks for the call. Eric, questions, I think, about the effectiveness of gun laws, people willing to break the law, willing to get guns. Does that kind of consideration factor into a court's decision?
Well, one justice in particular seemed very concerned about this. Justice Alito wrote a concurrence where he painted this picture of New York City that made it look sort of like Gotham from Batman, where people are constantly carrying around illegal guns and the bad guys have guns and the good guys need to have guns. New York, of course, contests that depiction. It's one of the safer large cities in the world right now, but the point is well taken. It's possible to illegally carry guns and a lot of people do it. So what do we do about that problem? I think that it's a challenging problem. There's a black market for guns out there. And one of the reasons why there's a black market for guns is because there are roughly 400 million in the United States. And guns are finding their way into inner cities, into the hands of dangerous people with criminal convictions who otherwise shouldn't have them. Now, to be sure, it doesn't matter what law you're talking about, what crime you're talking about. There always are people who are willing to commit it. Even though we prohibit murder, people still commit murders. And so just the mere fact that people are going to violate the law is usually not a good enough reason not to have the law in the first place. And I think that one of the goals with respect to keeping the firearms out of the wrong hands is to make it as hard as possible for guns to find their way into the black market and to get into those wrong hands, such as by expanding background checks and the like.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Eric Rubin from the Southern Methodist University School of Law, looking at the latest Supreme Court ruling on gun laws, a concealed carry law in this case in New York State. Eric, four states that require a permit for concealed carry. You mentioned they can do background checks. That seems to be constitutional still. What kind of restrictions can they have? If we find X in a background check, it is we can say no to your concealed carry application, and it's still constitutional for us to do that.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you're going to see states do now, especially policymakers in these affected states, is look at the existing restrictions on licenses that go beyond this heightened need for self-defense and make sure that they're optimal for the changed circumstances. I think that in places like New York, this need to show a heightened self-defense, that requirement was really the teeth of their restrictions. New York State, for instance, unlike many other states, did not require permit applicants to take any concealed carry class or to show any proficiency with a firearm in the range. There was no training requirement under New York State law. And that's because so few people could actually get through this other requirement. So tomorrow, New York State is actually calling back a special session of the legislature to consider changes to try to shore up their law. I expect that in addition to the background checks, you'll also see some sort of training requirement. I also wouldn't be surprised if policymakers look at so-called no-gun zones and sensitive places. The court has made clear that it's not calling into question whether or not you can ban guns entirely, whether or not you've got a permit from certain sensitive places like schools and government buildings, courthouses, polling places. And that list of places that the court has provided us with is not exhaustive. So I'd expect that there's going to be more attention on trying to carve out no gun zones, but we'll see what else happens when legislatures convene to try to optimize the law under these changed circumstances.
Did I see, when it comes to those no gun zones, did I see that in Justice Thomas's statement on this, that he said, yeah, you could still have gun zones, but don't push it. Don't use no gun zones to completely restrict people's ability to carry arms?
Yeah, that's it. And I think that this is just anticipating the next wave of cases. We'll see how far places like New York are going to go. At oral argument, there was talk about whether or not you could ban guns in Times Square on New Year's Eve or on the college campuses of NYU or other universities, in subways. So I think that one of the questions is how far can you go? Clearly, you can't declare all of New York City to be a gun-free zone. But what happens if you say you can't bring a gun within 1,000 feet of schools, for instance? That would carve out a lot of New York City. And would that go too far in the court's eyes? I think that the court probably doesn't want to become like a zoning commission for gun carry. But after this decision, they might find themselves in that position.
Briefly, as we wrap up, you mentioned some cases maybe hitting the Supreme Court. What is there one in particular you're watching for?
I'm watching three cases that deal with either large capacity magazines or so-called assault weapons. And these cases, which are out of New Jersey and in California and a couple other places, are the court's been holding on to them now for weeks and weeks, and they're going to issue their final orders, I'd expect, this Friday, just in 2 days from now. So I'll be looking to see whether or not they remand those cases for further consideration after this Bruin case on public carry, or maybe they'll take one of them. It'll be really interesting to see what they decide to do for next year. And if they decide to take one, I think that is a pretty big signal that this court is going to be taking a lot of Second Amendment cases in the coming years.
Eric, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. He talked with us about last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling striking down a New York gun law and what it means for the rest of the country. Coming up after the news, we'll look back at yesterday's testimony from a White House aide about former President Trump's actions before and during the January 6th attack on the Capitol. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time.